The air was thick, hot, stale, suffocating. Each breath felt like drawing in steam from a dying engine. Yuri wiped the sweat from his brow, but it was pointless. His uniform clung to him like a second skin, damp and reeking of salt and metal. The bulkheads groaned around him, the steel beast he was entombed in straining under the weight of the ocean above. The silence was the worst part. Not true silence, a submarine was never truly quiet. The hum of the engine, the distant creak of metal, the steady drip of condensation. But beneath it all was something else, something heavier. A silence that spoke of men holding their breath, of thoughts left unsaid, of hands hovering just above buttons that should never be pressed. A muffled voice broke the stillness, angry, urgent, raised voices. The officers were arguing again, about what Yuri could only guess. His stomach twisted at the thought, too many days in this floating coffin, too little air, too much fear. And now a decision had to be made. Yuri exhaled slowly, steadying himself against the bulkhead. He had faith in his commanders. He had to. What's the worst that could happen? It was just an argument. Not the end of the world. Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Cloak and Dagger podcast, the podcast where we tell nail-biting stories of history. My name is Patrick Courtney and I am joined, as ever, by my co-host, Will. Will, how are you doing on this crisp March day?
Frankly, I'm just really looking forward to recording. It's been a little bit of a while since just the way that our recording schedule's gone, and I'm really like ready to get into another story, especially as I don't have to do any of the work for it. All I have to do is sit here with you, listener, and hear Patrick tell us a tale.
It's not work. It's enjoying.
Of course, but there's no pressure on me.
That's true. Well, okay, we're now just adding pressure to me.
Building pressure, maybe.
Okay, fine.
Anyway, guys, welcome back to the podcast. It's great to be back on the air. You can follow us at Cloak and Dagger Podcast on Instagram, where you can see all of the posts that we put out for each episode. You know the drill by now. Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell a friend about us or leave a rating and review wherever you're listening?
Are we on the air? Does that count? Do people say that anymore? Because we're just not the air anymore. I mean, it is kind of. It's like the... It's technically in space, but like that's a radio thing.
Oh, but I love it. Like, I like to sort of hark back to the transistor radio period of time.
But we're not on air. Like, this isn't live.
That's true.
Does that count?
Yeah, no, you can still be.
Spoiler, I don't know if anyone thought this was live, but we're not actually there.
We're not actually in your ears.
Anything could
be
going on right now because this is in the future.
It's true, actually. Yeah. I always think, I always leave little notes for future Will, who does the time coding for episodes. So I'm like, hi, future Will, can you remember to take this out?
It's funny that we really think, I still think about this of just like us listening back to it later, as opposed to the many people who actually listen to it when it goes out. So
yeah, and again, you're not helping the pressure there for yourself, because suddenly there are 1,000 people now listening to every word that we're talking about.
Or more. It's the future.
It's true.
Any number of people could be listening to it.
Yeah. So shall we give them a show?
Sure. I think all the pressure's just plummeted now. All right, let's get started.
Okay, let's do it.
So today's historical tale will take place at a very interesting time in history, at the height of the infamous Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh my goodness. Yep. What great timing with the Kennedy papers just released That's really good timing.
Nothing's really come out from them, though, really.
63,000 words of social security numbers.
Yeah, essentially.
That is it. 63,000 pages, sorry, not words.
It really feels like it should have been something bigger, but literally nothing.
Well, I was actually listening to this on the way here, a podcast about it.
Oh, really?
And the only other thing that they have, which they realised why it was redacted before, is the CIA didn't want to people knowing how long they've been watching Lee Harvey Oswald, and also how...
Oh, there's so much, like, all terrorist attacks, it turns out, like the MI5 or CIA or whoever were watching them a lot. I mean, in fairness to them, they watch a lot of people, and I'd say probably like 95% of them don't do anything.
Yeah.
So like they couldn't have done much, but it's still embarrassing, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I think that is part of it. I think there was blowback. They thought there was going to be blowback from that. Mm. So that's part of the reason.
Oh, okay, fair.
But there's nothing in there. Although You never know. There could be things from the eagle if he ever comes back to the podcast. He might do it.
That's a hard reference. Listeners, if you don't know what that means, listen to all our previous episodes and somewhere you'll find out.
It's like an Easter egg.
But
no, we did an episode on the JFK conspiracy theories.
A phenomenal episode because neither of us did it.
Yes, and actually, ironically, one of our most popular episodes.
I think it's still our most popular episode.
Yeah, it might be because it had a huge spike when Trump came in, which is not surprising.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
So I think, so he might come on and do another one. We a friend of ours came on, aka the Eagle, who comes on and tells us.
He named himself. Yes. We didn't give him that name.
No. It's definitely self-named the Eagle.
Eagle, if you're listening to this, we kind of think it's a lame name.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, back to where you were.
But back to my episode, where you rudely derailed it immediately.
Instant derailment, that was. That might be a record of how quick I managed to derail.
I think I said one sentence.
He did.
I mean, I suppose, well, in fairness, the derailment was on topic, and then we went in different directions, so...
It's true.
I'll allow it. So, yes, the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
So, as you rightfully pointed out, incredible time in history under the reign of President Kennedy.
Some might call it that.
Sure. And I'm not going to go fully into the Cuban Missile Crisis, because there's a lot of stuff going on with it, but this episode is about a small incident that happened during it that could have had very big consequences.
Interesting.
So, to give you a bit of background on the Cuban Missile Crisis, if, dear listener, you don't know what that is, or you just don't know that much about it, the background of the Cuban Missile Crisis effectively starts, I would say, I'm sure there's probably historians that say it starts way earlier than this, but in 1959 with the Cuban Revolution, where the military dictatorship of President Fulgencio Batista was overthrown and they installed the Marxist revolutionary Fidel Castro.
Viva la Revolución!
Exactly. Interestingly, he was prime minister first. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, not president straight away.
Wow, that's good to know.
I guess it's an entirely new regime, like a whole new type of government as well. So they were unsure about, like, if they probably didn't want to use... Because the previous guy was President Batista. So they were probably like, we don't want to use that term. But then eventually he decided...
It was just a better word.
Actually, now I'm saying it, it's very like French Revolution. Well, we won't have any kings, and then an emperor comes along. Like,
yeah,
eventually
is.
They just become what they despised.
And it's also Che Guevara, right?
Yes. So he's in the mix. But the United States was not a fan of this revolution, partly because obviously they were in the middle of the Cold War, and being a Marxist revolutionary, a new Marxist communist state was now blossoming. Right next to America. I don't think I had quite... I mean, I did know this, but Cuba is so close to America.
Yeah.
It, at its shortest distance, it's 90 miles away.
That's nothing.
Yeah. Birmingham is further away from where we are now than where Cuba is to America.
For people who don't know, we're in London. So.
We're in London. Plymouth is, like, significantly further away from right here.
That is
than
so
if
close.
You're in... I mean, you have to be in Florida... But it's so close.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
That is
it doesn't
really
feel
weird.
Like it should be.
No.
It doesn't it should be further away.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It feels like the Caribbean should all be slightly further away from, like, mainland USA.
Yes, exactly.
But actually, it's not.
So, yeah, so the United States aren't happy about this. And the United States, up until this point, had a lot of influence over Cuba. Earl E.T. Smith, the former US ambassador to Cuba, once said that... Until Castro, the US was so overwhelmingly influential in Cuba that the American ambassador was the second most important man, sometimes even more important than the Cuban president.
See, that's too much oversight.
Good point, actually. I mean, you can understand why they would want a revolt.
100%.
Arguably.
Yeah.
So they kind of let it, you know.
Why were they so themselves. Interested?
Because they're right there. They're right on their doorstep.
So are the Bahamas. So, like, Trinidad. Well,
they were probably quite influential in all those places as well.
Really? So is it just that Cuba was the one that stood up to them?
I mean, in fairness, this is also during Cold War. They are probably, you know, America is hypersensitive about everything. And they're kind of in their empire-building teens, aren't they, really?
So. Yeah.
Like, that's the era they're in. Partly in response to all of Europe collapsing under war, and then this massive power to the east threatening them. So it makes sense, but then, you know, that level of control does
well, of course, and
ruin
also
other people's lives.
Because they were then another Soviet revolutionary force, if they ever made friends with Russia, which inevitably they probably will, not to give anything away, that then becomes quite a bit of an issue.
Exactly. And so what does the US do to make sure that Cuba does not become friends with the Soviets? They invade them.
They invade them,
but they do it cleverly because they get other people to do it for them.
Ah.
In an incident that you may have also heard of, the Bay of Pigs.
Bay of Pigs invasion, which was the closest we came to World... Not World War III, but like... Well, yes, nuclear holocaust.
I mean, I'd say so. I'm definitely at this point because they are... I mean, well, it's tricky because although Fidel Castro was a Marxist and Cuba was becoming a communist state, they weren't aligned to the Soviet Union at this point.
Oh, really?
But after the Bay of Pigs, they were.
Oh, right, okay.
So exactly what you were just saying about them wanting to keep Cuba away from the Soviets, they did it.
They pushed them into their arms.
I mean, they kind of pushed them into the arms of Fidel Castro and then pushed Fidel Castro into the arms of the Soviets.
So, like, the Bay of Pigs invasion, who was invading then if it wasn't them? Did they hire...
Cuban exiles. So there were lots of Cubans who fled Fidel Castro because of all sorts of reasons. They flee to America because their government was very close ties with America.
Mm.
So they flee there, and then the CIA, with the backing of President Kennedy, who at this point had only been on the job for 3 months.
What?
Which is a ridiculous thing to suggest an invasion. He's still in probation.
That is...
He could be let go at any point.
Love that.
I've only just thought of this. Heads of state should have probation.
Oh my
god.
You should be able to, like. Well, Liz Truss kind of did.
That's a really good point. God, like, she might be one of the only heads of state to actually fail her probation.
Yeah, so true.
Did she last less than. It was less than 3 months, wasn't it?
Less than the cabbage.
It was less than the cabbage.
Yeah.
She actually did fail probation.
She did, yeah. It was less than 100 days.
That's rough.
Way less.
That's rough.
Yeah.
Who does that?
Liz Truss. Yeah, she's
I'm trying to think, but even in history, I'm trying to think of people who lasted less.
Oh, I guess like the heads of state after Hitler before they surrendered to the Nazi. Mm. I mean, surrendered to the Allies.
Yeah, I guess. Very off topic, but what's it called? Robespierre.
Oh, yeah.
How long did he last? He was quite a while.
He was ages.
He was ages, over wasn't he? Yeah. I'm thinking of post-revolutions. I mean, Washington obviously lasted ages.
John Adams... I feel didn't last very long.
Or yeah, he lasted his course, but they have to last their course. They can't get kicked out early.
Yeah. A president died in office after like 30 days, but that's unfair, really, because death
with it. I mean, also go listen to 2 episodes ago where popes die within 3 days of becoming pope. So
yeah,
it's
well that was the 800s.
Though. Yeah, exactly. But the Bay of Pigs was an absolute disaster.
Really?
So, did not work. Fidel Castro's forces soundly defeated the Cuban exiles, who were, even though they were armed and trained by the CIA, just complete disaster. And Fidel Castro and his regime was like cemented into power.
Brilliant.
Could not have gone worse for the Americans.
Yeah. Complete own goal.
And what's worse, as I say, Cuba then decides, well, we're now enemies of America. We should probably cozy up to the Soviets.
I mean, fair.
Because why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it completely does.
Yeah. Like, it's... the Soviets aren't nice either, but...
But they are very far away from Cuba. So it's not like you're going to get too worried about them sort of taking over.
Mm. It's a strong point. And also, like, I do wonder whether or not, to a certain degree, the Soviets loved Cuba because of the image of Fidel Castro and Che Guevara. Like, they were cool and sexy and revolutionary and amazing, whereas the Soviets at this point had been in power quite a long time.
Yeah.
They'd lost their pizzazz.
They were less
sexy.
They were sort of tubby Gorbachev, men with brush moustaches.
Is it Gorbachev?
No.
It's not. It's
Khrushchev.
Khrushchev, that's what it is. Yeah. Khrushchev, not sexy. Not sexy. Not sexy.
He played by Steve Buscemi in A Death of Stalin.
Mm.
For anyone who's a fan of...
I forgot about that. Armando
Iannucci.
But the Cuban Missile Crisis came to a head in October 1962.
Okay.
When the US's greatest fears were confirmed because 2 American U-2 spy planes spotted launch pads and missile silos being constructed on Cuba.
Rats.
Yes. And so, it's the 16th of October that President Kennedy was informed. And this is like, I mean, in fairness to, probably shouldn't say in fairness to the Soviet Union. That's just not a good thing to say generally. Yeah. But this was partially also in response to America placing missile launches in Turkey and Italy. So very close to Russia. So
yeah,
nowhere near as close as Cuba is. So
Turkey is fairly close.
It's not 90 miles away.
Yeah, Soviet
Union. It's not as close as Plymouth.
Soviet Union. Soviet Union has Bulgaria.
Oh, great. Now so I actually, bring up a map.
It is. The Iron Curtain, it is as close. It's right on the Black Sea.
I'm going to check.
Okay.
You know what I've started checking on as well, rather than Google Maps? Google Earth? Google Maps lies to you. Oh, can you see it?
But wait, does it? What do you mean Google Maps lies to you?
Well, because it's a flat image, it warps. So, because Greenland looks the size of Africa on Google Maps. So you've got to look on a globe.
Okay.
I'll
keep that in mind.
Maps are terrible. Globes.
Gotcha. Globes of the future.
Right. Italy and Turkey.
Not Italy, but definitely Turkey.
Yes. No, you are absolutely right. Placing them in Turkey, massive provocation. They share a border.
Yeah.
Which Cuba doesn't.
No. Yeah.
Okay. So it's not quite an escalation. It's matching of aggressions.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, President Kennedy, to his credit, doesn't listen to his advisors, who all say they should just carpet bomb Cuba to destroy the Soviets' capacity to wage war.
Okay.
Which probably would have started World War III.
Could have been pretty bad, yeah.
Pretty, really bad. He decides, slightly different approach, he decides to blockade Cuba on the 24th of October. However, he calls it a quarantine. So it sounds a lot less warlike.
That's very good, because that sort of implies sickness.
It does. Yeah, which is more insulting, but less aggressive.
Less stabby.
It also sounds maybe like he's trying to help the world. Like it's preventing
an outbreak of COVID.
Yeah, exactly. Like there's something kind of medicinal. There's something like looking after the world about it.
Yeah,
to quarantine. I mean, it is a blockade.
That's 100%.
For all intents and purposes.
Yeah.
And then for 4 days, the whole world holds its breath. Everyone is terrified. World War III is so close to being set off. But on the 28th of October, President Kennedy and Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev come to an agreement and the two sides back down.
Brilliant.
So that is the Cuban Missile Crisis. Great result.
Phew.
If not, we probably wouldn't be here.
Nope. We would
definitely
be...
not this podcast.
Definitely not. Definitely not. We'd be talking in some auditorium, sort of like Odeon, with people passing by and throwing spears at us.
I don't think passing by and throwing spears at us.
Bad reviews were spears.
Oh, I see. So we're still doing this.
Oh, yeah.
But there are people with spears.
Exactly.
This is a very weird scenario where it's still a sort of podcast setting, but there are people with spears.
You just try and stop us. You can take away our technology, but you can't take away our podcasting ability.
The two things that survive, spear technology and podcasters.
Yeah.
God, that would be mind-numbing, wouldn't it? I know we are podcasts, but imagine they're the only people who survive. Right. So, crisis averted, Armageddon averted.
Yeah.
But during these events, there's a tale that fewer people know and almost no one knew about at the time, and that is the story of today.
Okay.
So, before we get into our tale, I need to introduce a man to you. His name is Vasily Arkhipov. And he was born to a peasant family in the town of Stryaya Kupavna, about 14 miles east of Moscow.
Okay, good.
So, good Russian fella. So Vasily was educated at a Russian naval academy, and at the age of only 19, he served in the quite short-lived Soviet-Japanese campaign of World War II. I didn't know there was one. Apparently it only lasted like a few weeks.
Didn't they just conquer that North Island and then
it up? And supposedly it's also one of the reasons that Japan was really considering surrender even before the bombs were dropped.
Really?
Why lots of people say that actually the bombs dropping was not necessary because the Soviets starting to invade. That's the thing. You could see Japan was probably like, you know, Germany has completely fallen under the might of Russia, and now they're starting to invade.
Yeah.
We're losing on our main front, and now a new front is about to arrive. They can see the writing on the wall.
Yeah.
So Vasily serves in this short-lived campaign aboard a minesweeper vessel. So I don't think he probably saw active combat, but certainly, you know, at war.
Yeah.
Quite a lot for a 19-year-old, and also quite a lot for his essentially year in industry. Because after the war, he goes back to the Naval Academy.
Does he?
Yeah. So
weird.
It really is like he's taking a break
from
uni.
Course.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a bit of life experience. It's really important.
Every Russian, Soviet Russian needs that.
Yes. Certainly given the decades to come.
Exactly.
Now, historical accounts all describe Vasily as quiet and level-headed. Most of the information we know about him comes from his wife, Olga, who described him as intelligent, polite, and very calm.
Okay.
That'll be important later.
Yeah. Steady hands.
Mm. And for any of our listeners who follow us on Instagram and any who don't follow us on Instagram, get over to Instagram because you can check out his picture because he's a pretty good looking fella.
Get over there.
I mean, let me show you.
This is like thirst bait.
It really is. I mean, you should see him. I mean, he's no young Stalin, but...
yeah.
Do you remember in Union that Stalin took over?
Yeah. He does look good with that neckerchief.
He does, isn't he? Right.
Oh, yeah.
He's a good looking fella, isn't he?
He actually...
Striking.
Striking is the word. That jawline.
Strong jawline. Very Russian.
Bit sullen. Quite,
I say Russian, but he could also be...
You know what I'd say he's giving me? Russian Superman.
Oh yes, that is a comic book,
is it?
Yeah, it's like Under the Red Sun or something like that. Yeah, they did. There's a whole comic book series about if he landed in Russia and he becomes like during Cold War, and he becomes like kind of fighter for like the Soviets, but still quite good. Like he's still, and then he resists all sorts of stuff.
Okay,
but yeah, no, I could see that. I could see that in him. So yeah, so interesting fella, good guy, like him. You're
good
looking. Tell that I'm good looking.
You're a fan.
I'm a big fan.
He's got his poster up in the bedroom.
So he graduates from the Naval Academy and goes on to serve on a submarine. Now, submarine warfare is a big deal at the time. Submarines, I didn't quite realize, but submarines have been around for a very long time. But World War II and then leading into the Cold War, submarines are huge. They're a really important asset.
Really?
And this building arms race between Russia and the United States, submarines are a huge component of that.
Am I right in saying that Cuba was actually supplied by submarine from the Russians?
I don't know, but that sounds right. I mean, well, if they're creating blockades, probably not during the Cuban Missile Crisis, although maybe.
I heard that. I've heard that somewhere.
Well, you've got to wonder, like, the only reason they knew about the missile silos or the launch pads, I don't know if they're actually silos, but the launch pads in Cuba that set off the Cuban Missile Crisis... They probably didn't notice, you know, ships just carrying missiles in and a bunch of, like, building equipment.
In their backyard.
So I wonder if that's possible. I mean, that sounds like it's a very slow going because submarines don't hold a lot. Like, most of the inside is spent on making sure it stays.
It works.
Because they're afloat, but I don't know if you can use a float for a submarine.
Right.
But, you know, there's not a lot of storage space on a submarine. But I suppose bit by bit, and if it means you can then supply arms under the radar...
Literally.
I mean, drug dealers use them to smuggle drugs across stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. You have all those drug cartels with those submarines. They've caught them.
Yeah, exactly. Didn't one, like, wash up in Cornwall or something? And one was like,
hilarious. Yeah.
Now, it was a difficult time to work on a submarine. As I say, these kind of, not early submarines, they're submarines that go way back, but this is still, like, before they became really solid. And particularly Russian submarines weren't great.
No.
Russia was constantly trying to keep up with the US in terms of their military capability. And because it's a Cold War, power is more associated with how you look as opposed to actual capability, really.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't really matter if you can actually do something as long as you can look like you're doing something. It's all that really matters. It's just kind of like a show-off contest at this point.
Yeah.
So the Soviet government are definitely more focused on speed over safety. In terms of these new vessels.
Really?
And this led to a disastrous event in 1961 known as the K-19 incident, which our pal Vasily found himself in the middle of.
Oh, really?
So the K-19 is a hotel-class submarine developed by the Soviets, and it was their first atomic submarine.
Oh, okay. So, terrifying for the US.
Very scary. I mean, I think that's the thing. So the US had just released their, and probably were very loud and shouty about their brand new atomic submarine. So the Soviets needed to catch up. Now, hotel class, I don't actually know what the Russians called it. That's the NATO description of it that's used everywhere. I couldn't actually find what they referred to it. And if it did, it's probably in complicated Russian. So
yeah,
that's probably why I didn't find it.
Yeah.
So the K-19, very impressive in theory, but it was a shambles from the start.
Oh, no.
10 people died in its construction. So 2 died in a fire. 6 women died from inhaling poisonous fumes while they were, like, fusing rubber and glue together.
Oh, God.
1 engineer fell between 2 compartments and died. And a final one was crushed by a missile tube cover that fell onto him.
This is all before it's left the factory.
Before it's left the factory, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
that just tells you so much about the health and safety regulations in Soviet Russia.
Exactly. Well, they're not that bothered about it, clearly.
Yeah. Oh, God.
And then even before its launch, on the day of its launch, there were even more signs that it was, you know, destined to fail.
Yeah.
So, you know, the ceremonial smashing of a bottle of champagne across the stern of a ship?
I always think that's always going to fail.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you don't think it should fail.
No.
But who knows? So instead of the tradition of using a woman, they used a guy, a captain, which, you know, back then, bad juju, but nowadays, gender roles flipped, who cares?
Yeah.
The bottle also didn't smash.
Oh, no.
It bounced off the submarine and fell into the water.
Oh, no.
So very, and obviously, it's sailors that are going to be in this.
Very suspicious.
Deeply superstitious.
So it was superstitious and probably suspicious.
Well, you're superstitious about the bottle. You're suspicious about those 10 engineers that have stopped showing up to work.
Yeah, and the black smoke coming out the east side of where you're going to be living. Honestly, submarines, man. I don't get the point.
Coffins, like, in the sea.
Do you see? So there was just today, there was a tourist submarine that imploded in the Nile. Or like in the Red Sea.
Nile?
Red Sea, not
that
the Nile.
Makes sense.
Yeah,
like the billionaires one.
Yeah.
A year ago or whatever.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah,
39 people were rescued, but 6 died.
Christ. Yeah.
So it's like, why? Why would you want to go down there? All that pressure. People aren't thinking
it's
science.
A lot in the...
People just go, oh, it's under the water. But actually, they
pressure.
Don't...
It's like a mountain on top of you.
Exactly. Mm. They don't think like that. And I, yeah. even with my GCSE physics, I know.
You think like that. Yeah,
I get it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, your instincts are right. I mean, if you joined a, you know, Russian-Soviet submarine in the 60s. Probably also quite bad nowadays, anyway. So, in command of this ill-fated? Yeah. In command of this ill-fated vessel was Captain Nikolai Zatayev, who appointed Vasily Arkhipov as his executive officer.
Ah.
So he's about 35 at the time. So okay. He's done quite well. Executive officer, second in command of literally like the cutting edge, like the highest of the high. Like, I mean, probably more than any of Russia's destroyers as well. Like, this is really cutting edge technology.
Yeah, because it's the nukes.
Yes, exactly. It's hugely important. But also just nuclear submarines have so much of a tactical advantage over diesel submarines anyway, because they can last for so much longer. They can fly way further under the radar. It's just universally way better.
Is that because they're using nuclear power as well as having nuclear warheads?
Yes. So, clarity, the atomic submarine is an atomic-powered submarine. I think they also had nuclear weapons on board as well. But the revolution here is to have the boat, the submarine, powered by nuclear fusion.
I was so thinking
fission.
I thought it was a diesel engine nuclear warhead submarine.
No.
But it's an atomic... Right, sorry. I'm now
submarine.
Up.
Yeah,
right,
yeah. Okay. So that's why it's a huge revolution, because that's a lot. Because also, I mean, building a nuclear bomb, it's not easy, but it's a lot easier than building a nuclear reactor.
Yeah.
Like, getting sustained power in a safe way from nuclear fission is so much harder than just bombarding a bunch of atoms with high radiation and then blowing it all up. Like, it's really difficult. And doing it in a confined space under the ocean, very difficult. So 2 years into the life of this vessel, after hundreds of like smaller engineering problems that just plagued this boat for its entire life, Kane-19 was conducting exercises in the North Atlantic Sea, just off the coast of Greenland, where it encountered a major problem.
Oh, no.
The crew detected a massive leak in the coolant system that fed the submarine boat's nuclear reactor.
Oh, no, that's really bad.
Really bad.
Yeah.
And, well, it would get a lot worse, but in the immediate term as well, the reactor starts heating up, which means the temperature inside the submarine is just going up and up and up.
Oh my God.
Really unpleasant.
Those poor Russian sailors.
Yeah, exactly. And they, you know, they were doing everything they could. There are control rods that they can put into a reactor which slow the fission reaction. Doesn't do much. You know, it slows it down a bit, but the reactor is still slowly going into meltdown.
Okay. What's the issue with that? I mean, for the listeners and
me. So, I mean, I'm not going to go into too much detail because nuclear reactors are quite complicated. However, the basic idea is that unstable atoms like uranium and plutonium, if you give them enough energy, they will start to split apart and release a ton of energy. And they will also release atoms that can go and knock into other uranium atoms that release more energy.
Chain reaction.
Yes. So it will just start to, they call it burning and stuff like that, but it's not real fire. It's this nuclear fission reaction.
But on a
yes, exactly.
Sub.
But you do it in a way that you can control how quickly it happens, and then in normal like reactor where you use that to heat water, turn turbines and create electricity and do everything else you need. And also, in itself, it will create a lot of heat.
But as soon as that becomes an unrestricted
an uncontrolled reaction. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So this is what's different about fission and fusion. So fission is the breaking apart of these really massive atoms that are like really unstable.
Okay.
And in them breaking apart, they release tons of energy. But because them breaking apart also causes other atoms to break apart, it just becomes this cascading reaction that can be controlled when done properly. But you need coolant. And this is what was going wrong in here. So their cooling system was breaking down.
Gotcha, gotcha. But so with the size of their nuclear reactor on board or whatever it is, their atomic engine, what could it just blow apart and that would just... Like, how big a meltdown are we talking about if it was to go...
Well, the problem is it doesn't have to do that much damage to kill every single person on board.
It just has to break apart the...
Well,
the
realistically, yeah. That's the thing. One, it's powering the submarine. Like, submarines are basically at a very tenuous position normally.
Yeah.
Like, it just has to do a good chunk of damage. It's very interesting. I don't know. I'm sure there's probably videos online talking about, like, what would happen with a full-on meltdown in a submarine... I mean, now I'm thinking it must have happened, but like, because then as soon as it breaks apart, it's then flooded with a bunch of seawater, which should calm it down.
Yeah.
Kind of, but it's radiation. It's complicated. I mean, it would like, the reaction would vaporize all the water around it, which would cause this huge flood of vapor water in all, amongst all this other water, which would rock up into the sky. So it would kind of mess up the water around it. But you are still in an ocean, so I don't know. Like
infinite water, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Like it would all start like flying in, and I don't know. It's okay. A really interesting thought experiment. I'm going to look that up as soon as I finish this because I do wonder if that's happened and what would happen, or whether you could see it on the surface.
Yeah,
that'd be
interesting.
Something.
I guess it would depend how deep they were.
Yes, and also it would depend on the reaction itself, how much uranium is there, you know, and. Submarines are also quite small, like they don't need a huge... Like the point of having it nuclear powered is it means it doesn't have to surface, it doesn't need refueling as often. It's not like Chernobyl where they're trying to power an entire nation.
Yeah.
They're literally just trying to power a small little boat.
I have one more question before you go on.
Of course.
What the bloody hell were they doing in Greenland?
Sus things.
Okay.
It's the Soviets, isn't it? Like, they're performing... exercises.
Ah.
Whatever that means.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, you also got to think, because if you look on a map, and I'm going to show you the globe again.
Oh, I know. Greenland and Russia are quite close.
Well, because this is, again...
Because over the top.
I was just telling you about how maps are rubbish.
Yeah.
Because you look at it from, like, left to right, and you're like, Russia and America are miles apart. They're on either sides of the map. But really, you look top down, they're facing each other with Greenland in the middle.
Yeah.
So
there's a reason why Trump is interested in Greenland, and it's not just that, we're not going into it, but there are other reasons too.
So this is a disaster for the K-19 and its crew, and it's particularly bad as well because this is a cutting edge piece of tech. You know, the captain at the time he can't just scuttle the ship and get away.
No,
he has to say, I mean, he'll get sent to a gulag if he does that. Like
if he
needs
gets home.
To say exactly.
Yeah.
He needs to recover it. He needs to do something. So he makes the radical decision to try and fix the reactor. So he orders his engineers to fabricate a new makeshift cooling system by welding a water supply pipe to an air vent in the reactor. Basically, it sounds like, and it's probably way more complicated than this, but it does feel like he's just funneling water towards the reactor
right.
to cool everything down.
Wow, okay.
Complicated.
Very complicated.
It works.
Oh, brilliant.
But all the engineers die.
What?
Within about a week, because they are exposed to huge amounts of radiation because they have to work during... And if it's in meltdown, it means it's releasing more radiation than is planned. I mean, you're probably... And also back then, even when it's working perfectly, you're probably getting irradiated to a certain degree.
Of course.
Not having kids anytime soon.
No.
But yeah, they are exposed to a huge amount of radiation. So all 8 members of the engineering crew died from radiation exposure over the course of the next few weeks. But also, because the reactor, I mean, partly because they're pumping so much water into it, it's releasing a huge amount of steam that is highly radioactive that gets into the air filtration system, which means the entire crew gets irradiated as well.
Radioactive gas.
Yes, radioactive steam.
That's so...
flowing into your pressurized tube hundreds of meters below the ocean.
And also, these guys, whilst apart from the engineers who will have some nuclear understanding of nuclear reactions, the rest of the sailors won't know what they're dying of.
Yeah, it's quite terrifying, really.
Yeah.
So the rest of the crew, so within the next 2 years, 15 more sailors die. And they all have quite severe, like, ailments from this radiation as well.
So, okay, hang on. 15 die over the next 2 years.
15 over the first day and 8 within the first few weeks.
Okay, and how big is the the boat's complement?
About 100.
Okay, wow.
So nearing a quarter.
And also the ones who are highly trained. Well, you know, the engineers at least.
The engineers are all gone. I mean, they're gone in the first few weeks.
Oh, God.
And so, I mean, you know, you'd hightail it back very quickly. But the whole episode is just such a disaster. In fact, the crew of K-19 and many other members of the Russian Navy give K-19 a really endearing nickname for the time. They called it Hiroshima.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a completely different... Okay, fine. Okay.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, you know, nuclear disaster, so...
Fair enough. I guess it's before Chernobyl, so...
Thankfully, however, Vasily Arkhipov is not one of the people who die.
Lucky.
Very lucky. I mean, executive officer, maybe in a back room, maybe not, you know.
Yeah, hermetically sealed
yes,
door.
Yes, part of the people sending... But, you know, you've got to keep a level head in this situation. You've got to keep people in charge. And this is proof that he could deal with these sorts of situations. And he's, frankly, just used to these sorts of situations. High-pressure situations in really extreme, like, scenarios.
Yeah.
500 meters below the ocean.
100%. Yeah.
So very important for his later life.
Ah, so his CV is bulking out a bit with these pretty impressive things.
You'd put that in your CV, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Yes. Survived K-19 incident.
Well, I don't know, but you don't want to be associated with the K-19 incident.
You just blame the guys who died.
Jeez, the engineers who saved everyone.
This is Soviet Russia. This is not a time for quibble.
Okay, so we jump now back to October 1962 to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Soviet nuclear launch pads have been detected across Cuba, and the US have set up their quarantine.
Oh, yes. Very nice.
I did air quotes for people. I always do this on this, and you have to explain. Is there a way of saying air quote? I suppose you just say...
Quote, unquote.
Quote, quarantine, unquote.
No, you say quote, unquote, quarantine. That's how they do it. That is how the pros do it.
That's rubbish. But whatever. Tensions are at a boiling point, and the doomsday clock is at 7 minutes to midnight.
Oh my goodness.
Which I think, and I believe we wanted to get to the end of this story, is a massive understatement. Doomsday people were way off on their estimation that it's only 7 minutes to midnight.
Yeah.
So, where do you find Vasily Arkhipov at this point?
I'm guessing somewhere off the coast of Cuba on a submarine.
And you are absolutely right.
Really?
He is aboard the B-59 submarine beneath the waves of the Sargasso Sea. Sargasso?
Oh, Sargasso Sea.
The Sargasso
Sea. Where all the eels go.
Yes, and it's just east of Cuba.
Oh, so he's swimming in eels.
He's not swimming. That'd be insane. Now, the B-59 is a Foxtrot-class submarine, so not as cutting-edge as the K-19, and it is a diesel-powered submarine. Okay. So, you know, could count as a downgrade, or he's like, thank God I'm not on those bloody... atomic submarines.
Yeah.
I need to stay as far away. Can't get radiation from diesel.
Yeah. He's probably sniffing that petrol like,
Yeah. Oh, this is so much nicer. Yeah.
I love the smell of diesel in the morning.
So in command of the B-59 is Captain Valentin Grigorovich Savitsky. Also on board is Ivan Maselenikov, who is the political officer on board. Do you know what a political officer is?
Yes. Well, I'm pretty sure I do. Aren't they the guys who look for sedition against the state?
Exactly.
Yeah.
They are responsible for political ideology of a unit.
Mm.
Guess where they first were created?
The Nazis.
No. French Revolution.
The French Revolution.
Yeah, French Revolutionary Army were the first people to set up this. And then also Spanish Civil War, they had them, so the communists there.
Wow.
Nazis also had them as well. And they're currently being used in China's People's Liberation Army.
Really?
Yeah, so they're still in force.
Huh.
And I bet there's kind of sort of versions of it in every army, really.
Surely, yeah, because you need to keep cohesion to the state.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I bet there was probably... I wonder if there was something similar, like... Maybe not an official role, but I always wonder about like medieval armies where like peasants might just run. Like, you need someone to, like, get people involved and really caring about it. Maybe not really, but, like, in some way thinking at least I'll try a bit harder. Because it's probably not that costly and would, if it could fight them 5% harder, it's a big reward.
Holy men.
Oh, the church. You're right.
Yeah. Because if you're fighting the Moors, sorry, that is the term for the time.
Yeah,
you'd have your the holy men on the front lines going, "We got to do this for Christ." And then in the Crusades, Christ. It's the same.
Mm.
They're there
when you're just invading your neighbours of the county over. They're like, "Those guys, they were blaspheming on Sunday. We've got to go kill them."
Exactly.
You're so right. But we're in, you know, post God, God is dead world.
Yeah.
You know. So you need political officers to push people ahead.
100%.
That's really interesting because also French Revolution, you know, Enlightenment era, it is when people stop caring about that. I mean, they fucking hated the church.
They did.
So they needed their equivalents.
Yeah.
It's a very good point. Good. I'm glad we figured that out.
Thank you.
I'm sure other people have come up with that, but I think that was a success.
Yeah.
And so now finally we also have Vasily Arkhipov, who on top of being executive officer once again, so second in command, he was also chief of staff for the flotilla. So the flotilla would have been a number of different submarines deployed. Chief of staff, not head, but, you know, high-ranking official, I think. It's complicated. I was looking up this and there was information on what, like, a chief of staff is in British command. And it seems clear that there is differences, but it's complicated.
So was his, my question would be, was his submarine the flagship?
Possibly. It's hard to tell. There's a huge number of submarines that are like deployed at this point. A lot of them do get caught quite quickly though. So,
okay.
And also I don't know if they would have flagships to a degree because most of the submarines aren't really communicating with either each other or anyone else.
Yes, because they're meant to be lone wolves, aren't they?
Really radio silence. They're given a huge amount of leeway to act as they see fit. I mean, they have standing orders about what to do in certain scenarios, but they don't have a lot of communication with Moscow. They don't, and also partly because they want to be quiet, they don't want to be spotted, but also because it's hard to, you know, communicate with people when you're so far beneath the waves.
Yeah, but if they got nuclear warheads, you'd probably want them to be slightly, at least in touch.
Would you though? False commands, all sorts of stuff like that?
Possibly, yeah. But I'd hate for it to be come down to, say, one or two people who haven't been chosen for their... You know what I mean? Like, I can just imagine that going really wrong.
Yeah. One or two people would be ridiculous. That's
right?
That's insane. Three, though. Much more reasonable, right? Because while this is not an atomic-powered submarine, it does have nuclear warheads on board.
No.
Yes.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
And they are sailing right into Cuban waters during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh, my goodness.
Classic Russia.
Yes. Are they delivering them or are they standing there as a sort of...
They're just there.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's just hanging
nothing,
out.
Nothing sus about this.
Yeah, don't be suspicious. well, what is on holiday?
So they're in the waters and then on the 27th of October, so this is very deep into Cuban Missile Crisis. The blockade is up. Everyone is at, you know, as I said at the beginning, nail biting. You know, this is the most tense I think the world may have ever been. And on the 27th of October, the United States Navy detects the B-59.
Oh, my goodness.
So a group of different ships, so destroyers and air carriers, all detect the presence. And despite the fact they are officially on international waters and also officially not at war with the Soviet Union at this point, like it's a Cold War. They're not officially at war.
Yeah.
And it's the most tense scenario ever. The US Navy still decides to drop signaling charges at the submarine.
No. Were they like depth charges?
Yes, depth. Sorry, signaling depth charges
right.
at the submarine.
There's barrels that explode and cause like, I've seen it in like Das Boot and
stuff. Yeah, huge amounts of damage. Now, to be fair, they are exploding well above the submarine. The point of this is to try and force the submarine to surface so it can be identified. So it's less direct attacking by sort of direct attacking. Slightly indirect attacking.
I'm just thinking that the 60s aren't known for their accuracy.
So just in general, the 60s are not known for their accuracy.
Well, yeah. I mean, they couldn't even spot the bloody missile silos till they've been built.
Or like US Navy, Beatles, none of them were good at accuracy.
Right? And so suddenly, imagine if one of your depth charges was just a little bit too low and you hit a nuclear submarine.
Exactly.
Not the nuclear-powered ones.
No.
No.
If anything, worse. Because yeah. You hit nuclear, something's going to go wrong and they'll have to surface, whereas the diesel ones are reliable.
Yeah.
And they do have nuclear torpedoes.
And the worst thing would be, if you did it right at the wrong angle, you'd hit it, make it surface, and set off the nuke as it gets nearer to the surface.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
Yeah. And that'd be really shit.
No, it would sink. I don't think it would, because if it would break, it would flood with water.
Yeah.
And would just sink.
Okay.
Like, submarines don't float to the surface when they're destroyed. They wreck on the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah.
Nice and far away. So actually, it probably made sense for them. They were probably, let's just destroy this and send it to the deep.
Yeah, okay.
Now, on board the B-59, as I say, very little contact. They hadn't actually had any contact from Moscow for a number of days. And possibly the only radio communication they would have received would have been potentially accidentally from the Americans, because only 5 days prior to it, President Kennedy had given an announcement to the nation, basically saying that they would regard any nuclear missile launch from Cuba as an attack against the entire Western Hemisphere, and that it would have full retaliatory response to the Soviet Union.
Oh my God.
So that might have been the only thing they heard, and then suddenly they're kind of under attack.
Right, yeah. Saber-rattling going on.
Saber-rattling, or for all the crew know, World War III has broken out.
Yeah, because you're underground.
Because they don't know.
Or underwater, sorry.
Yeah, they're underwater. Like, this could be... So, like, in their mind, they could be like, war has broken out. We heard the president announce that he's basically ready to go for war. They probably know that, like, Cuba has a bunch of missiles on it and their superiors very likely could have fired first, or anything could have happened.
Yeah.
So if you're on board and you've got standing orders to fight back if you're under attack...
Honestly... What the hell? Okay, and the paranoia on board. Can you imagine?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And as you said, two people deciding this would be insane. But there were three commanding officers on board.
Three?
Captain Savitsky, political officer Maslennikov.
Oh, I don't like the sound of him.
And...
In this scenario.
And executive officer Vasily Arkhipov.
Right.
Captain Savitsky says, we should launch.
Oh my God.
Political officer Maslennikov agrees. Executive officer Vasily Arkhipov says no.
Hang on a second. So, just explain to me the protocol.
All three of them must agree.
Right. Could they not just knock off Arkhipov and replace him with another chief of staff?
They could, but their orders are all three of them have to agree. It's not like a power grab. It's a decision.
Right.
And so... It becomes an argument, like we heard in the walkthrough.
Yuri was hearing it.
Yeah, exactly. Yuri's a fictional character, but there was probably a hundred guys on there.
He lingers. He lingers in the memory.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so they... Quite a fierce argument, apparently. They are debating whether or not to attack, and Captain Savinsky and political officer Maslennikov are fully on board with firing a nuclear torpedo at the ship that is attacking them, because that is what their orders are.
No, that's stupid.
Well, they're under attack.
Yeah, no. But shooting a nuclear torpedo at something which you're close to is not make any sense.
Does sound... Well...
That does not make sense.
Well, I would imagine...
Surely
they would move away and fire it.
Yes, but you would...
It's a complicated situation.
Yeah. How many nukes have they got on board?
But also, for all they know, and which might make it even more terrifying, is that they may not have been planning on surviving this attack. They were we are under attack. We are at war. If we service, they kill us. We cannot survive. They know we're here. We cannot survive down here. Let's take a few of them with us. Let's fire our nuclear torpedoes as we are ordered to do.
Really? So I'm trying to get my head around this. You've got a nuclear bomb, which is more powerful than the one that hit Hiroshima, because we're 20 years later or 15 years later.
Yeah.
And they the decision is to try and hit a local ship.
I mean, a destroyer or an air carrier is a pretty big
thing. With a nuke. That's like trying to hit a fly with a shotgun.
Well...
Surely, if I was in there...
Hang on, let me check, because also, it's a nuclear torpedo.
Yeah.
Torpedoes are meant to be fired ship to ship. They're not meant...
It's not one that goes up.
It's not an intercontinental ballistic missile.
Right.
It is a torpedo.
So their options are limited.
Yeah, well, I also imagine it's designed to attack other ships. So the decision to decide to attack that other ship probably makes more sense.
Yeah, okay. But still, it does feel like overkill.
Mm.
Don't you think?
I mean, yeah. I mean, I'd say all of this is probably overkill, if I'm honest.
Arkhipov is definitely... I'm on his side on this. I mean, I would be anyway, because it's nuclear holocaust otherwise.
I mean, we're living today, so I would say we should definitely be on his side.
Yeah, Russian Superman.
But that's the thing. One vote. One vote from one guy decided that they shouldn't go start World War III.
Was there no oversight from Moscow then?
Couldn't communicate. And that's the point. That's what's so terrifying about all of the Cold War, is that all of these places, submarines particularly, but other places, you never know whether or not communication's been scrambled. You don't know what's happened. There could be informants or like spies in Moscow. So loads of these installations, either missile silos or submarines or whatever, have standing orders to act in a certain way, to hell with whatever communication you get. Unless, presumably, you can get a very specific order to call off an attack. But submarines won't get that.
Bloody hell. Okay, so what happens then?
They don't fire.
Seriously?
Yeah, you need all three votes. And also, Vasily Arkhipov manages to convince the other two to not attack. So it's not so it's not like they go, well, two votes against one, we need unanimous, so we don't do it. He's able to talk them down from the breach. And I would imagine a huge part of that is the reputation he has as being calm, being level-headed, and having dealt with a situation not dissimilar to this.
Wow. So as in, okay, so first of all, brilliant, saves the world, kind of.
You can probably see why I thought he was so good looking.
Yeah.
It's not just the jawline. It's also the fact that he saved both our lives and everyone we've ever known and everyone we've not known.
Well, yes. And I love that. And I love the idea that he won them over with words. But was it sort of a three key have to turn at the same time scenario?
I've read that in places. I don't know if possibly, but I sort of think that... I don't think they have... Well, I mean, maybe they do. I've seen people say that.
Oh,
but
really? I'm not, well, that was a complete guess. That's just what I've seen on, you know, movies and stuff.
That's why I'm not sure, because I've not seen any actual evidence, or like no historical telling of it, but loads of like articles say there's three keys, and I can't tell if they're just being, you know, flowery
like
with the language.
Like me, yeah. Being sort of Hollywood.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think arguably they probably would do that, but that's more just a practical fail-safe method to make sure you don't accidentally send it off.
Okay.
You know, so they
so you can just swallow the key and
probably
run away.
They probably do all have three. They probably do all have keys.
Yeah.
But they would just hand them over to people who are actually operating the torpedoes and stuff like that. It's not like they were fighting to get his key or something. But but who knows?
But also, imagine if Arkhipov, like, this could end his life in that, not by saying no to his senior officers.
Yes, so he's probably about the same level as the captain, and the political officer would be technically below those two. Because although he's executive officer, which is technically second in command, because he's chief of staff
for the flotilla,
it's a bit more unwavy. It's why they're all three of them are given like the right for the vote.
Right.
Because it's they need to make sure that there are people who are willing, you know. The Russians aren't idiots. They know they can't put it all down onto one person. They probably saw Dr. Strangelove, which, you know,
yeah,
is exactly
brilliant.
That.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. You need a bit of a fail-safe. But, I mean, it's just mind-boggling.
So, Moscow had absolutely no idea how close they came until the mission report afterwards.
Exactly. No one knew.
How did this story come out, then?
So, it comes out many years later, because the Russians don't talk about it. In fact, very sadly, when the crew returned to Russia, so eventually they decide, not worth it, our batteries are dying, we need to now leave. So they surface and just get kind of caught by the US, and they are able to just head home. I mean, you know, technically the US and Soviet aren't actually at war,
so
they can't, and they're in international waters, so they can't stop them.
Right.
But as soon as they surface, the US tag them, they can't, they're no longer that big of a threat.
Sure.
So they head back to Russia, and they are faced with disgrace.
Really?
Yeah, the Russian high command completely admonished them. They are seen, they're considered not like traitors, but just failures, really. Like, they should have gone down, like, they shouldn't have been caught, I think is the big thing, is the fact that they were forced to surface. So they were losing power, and, you know, it was a difficult situation, so they decided to surface. And I think that's what they really got in trouble for. Not necessarily for not starting World War III.
Right.
I assume the Soviets were probably quite happy they hadn't done that.
Yeah.
Because they don't really want a rogue submarine kicking off the war on their behalf.
No.
If the US didn't trigger it.
Honestly. I mean, I mean, I totally know what you mean. I mean, I'm just quickly thinking the two things that have come to my mind of how close we have come to using nukes again, right?
Oh my God, dude. There's
so many. But you know the one in North Carolina where two bloody atom bombs fell off the side of a bloody bomber and they just land and didn't detonate?
I got to admit,
like, North Carolina.
There is, I'm sure a lot of it happened in Russia as well and we don't know about it, but there's a whole Wikipedia article about nuclear close calls.
Yeah.
And like half of them are the Americans dropping them.
Yeah.
Just like they're just falling off the back of a wagon or... quite often they are all accidentally dropped from the planes they're carrying them, but they haven't been activated yet. But it's still like that much speed and that crashing down. It is very hard to set off a nuclear explosion.
Yes.
It could have still done, it could have had some sort of explosion and just fired all this like radiation into the air.
Yeah.
So it could be still really bad.
Yeah.
But yeah, and insane.
I'm learning a lot about the Korean War at the moment because I'm trying to clue up on modern history because I'm so bad at it. And I'm learning a lot from you with all your podcasts in this era. But Douglas MacArthur, who was the head of the UN forces out there, was always going, let's just go nuke China. He kept saying, let's use it. Let's just chuck a nuke. And insane. I'm like, what are you doing?
Insane. No. Absolutely insane.
Yeah. It's madness. Yeah. For someone who grew up in the 90s and the noughties, like that seems like so... it's outlandish. But back then, it was far more like an option. People thought that the world was not going to see into the 21st century.
Yeah, well, they just kind of, there was just an assumption that this is how war works now.
Yeah.
And it's remarkable that it isn't.
It's incredible. It's people like Arkhipov who have actually made sure that that hasn't happened.
100%. He's a spectacular hero. Sadly, he is disgraced when he comes home, but he continues his career. In 1975, he's promoted to Rear Admiral, and then in 1981, he's promoted to Vice Admiral, and then in 1988, he retires, and in 1998, he passes away from kidney cancer. Probably related to the radiation he was exposed to on the K-19 incident.
Goodness me. And
but that's really recent.
Yeah, that's really recent.
27 years ago? Quite a long time ago, actually.
We're getting old.
But within our lifetimes.
Yeah.
This hero survived then. And it wasn't until 4 years later, in 2002, during the Cuban Missile Crisis Havana Conference, which marked the 40th anniversary since the Cuban Missile Crisis, that a commander, Vadim Orlov, who was present for the events, recounted the tale for the first time. So the whole world didn't know. I mean, obviously the Russians probably knew, but most of the Russians didn't know. But this is the first time the whole world became aware of this moment in time where a single guy's vote saved us from World War III.
And the tragedy is that Arkhipov had been dead for 4 years.
Yeah. Well, I bet that's probably related.
Yeah.
I would assume they would, like, this sort of thing. I mean, you know, declassifying of files, I think they only do it when all the participants have passed.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't. There's too much danger that it could blow back on them while they're around.
Madness. I can't believe it took until 2002 to find that out. But I mean, what an unsung hero. Literally, that guy went to his grave knowing that he'd stopped, well, and stopped World War III. He probably thought at the time it wasn't such a massive deal, because he probably thought, oh, it's going to happen again. If it's got to this point already, in a couple of years it's going to happen again. You know, and then he saw Chernobyl in 1985.
Wow,
we're in trouble. You know what I mean?
God.
But yeah, no, interesting.
Be very interesting to know what he thought about Chernobyl, actually, because that is a disaster that, like, it wasn't someone's choice, but it was, you know, I can say malpractice, but, you know, there were, like, problems with it and oversights and all sorts of things that caused it. And, like, it's just such a shame that that's how it happened. And actually, you know, he was level-headed enough to avoid that, but then... just later down the line, mistakes happen, and then arguably probably a worse incident. I mean, it didn't cause World War III, so arguably less worse. But as I said before, reactors can do a lot more damage because they just continually burn.
Yeah.
Whereas a bomb is one and done, mostly.
Yeah.
Still pretty bad.
Of course. Yeah. Nuclear bombs are bad. That is something we can agree on.
Yes, 100%. And look, you could read into why I was looking into this story, just something about the events of the last few months has just put the Cuban Missile Crisis somehow in my mind. But I think it's a really important... what's really just horrifying is the fact that you don't really need... like, heads of state don't need to make the decision to start World War III. If they make the decision to get close, something else will trigger it.
Yeah.
I mean, World War II, that's... And World War I and II, like, it's just... Maybe not II. But World War I, you know, it's triggered from some other event that causes everything to... Like, if everyone's just ready to go for war, even if you're saying to everyone it's a deterrent, you still do all the work to get ready to go to war, and there's not much to tip you over the edge.
Yeah.
And with nuclear war, it's so much worse.
It really is. One small trip, and then you're over the cliff.
Yeah, 100%.
So with that, I mean, I hope you guys aren't feeling too anxious after hearing that.
it's a heavy story, but I think a positive one.
It is. Of course it is. Yeah, because it was evaded. At the end of the day, this is a success story.
It was evaded. And remember, Vasily Yakupov, peasant born... You know, not, you know, one of the working class, you know, man of the people.
Yeah.
Good looking dude. You know, these are the people we need.
And he lived a long time. Like, he did well. It wasn't like he died of really quickly.
He afterwards. Did very well. And actually, yeah. He was also posthumously awarded a Future of Life Award from the Future of Life Institute in 2017. It was given to his family just for saving the entire world.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's kind of recognized. And actually, at that conference where it was all revealed, Thomas S. Blanton, the director or the former director of US National Security Archive, credited Vasily as the man who saved the world.
Wow. Well, that is quite the tale.
Mm.
And when you're listening to this, tucked up in bed at night, save a prayer for
Vasily Yakupov.
Yeah. Wherever you are in your Soviet heaven.
I don't think, is there anyone else who could say they saved the world? Like, actually, like, only them. Like, no one else. Like, not part of a wider push.
Sadly, there probably have been more of them.
That's a really good point.
We won't hear about them until someone like that guy tells the world. It could be happening right now. Again, we're dealing high paranoia today.
Mm.
We're really triggering people. I'm so sorry. If you need to chill, go back to one of our other episodes, which are sort of ancient in theme.
Yes, less likely to demoralise you in present day. I mean, none of them are positive.
This is why I don't like modern history, because it just makes me go, it's too close to home.
Mm.
It's far too close to the modern day. And then I go, this could happen again, you know. Whereas I'm not thinking about sort of like swords and sandals, Archimedes getting invaded in Sicily.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know. You're not worried about another crusade.
No. Well.
That didn't work out. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You made that too easy.
So let me rephrase that. You're not worried about another Black Death.
I don't know. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for listening, everyone. I hope you've enjoyed the episode. I loved learning about this, and I like it when we can tell tales of people who are lesser known. That's kind of the point of this podcast. Sometimes we talk about very famous people, but it is fun when we talk about people who are very lost to history, even though they had huge impact.
Yeah.
So, yeah, hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was really fun to listen to. And join us next time for another episode of the Cloak & Dagger podcast.
Yes, thank you, everyone.